Guardian Unlimited.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, podcast to you every week from Guardian HQ. I'm Alex Kratosky, and as always, I'm joined by our venerable gaggle of podcasters, Jemima Kish, Bobby Johnson, and Charles Arthur. Hello, guys. Welcome
Hi.
Back after
Hello.
Christmas. Did you have a good time?
In all probability, yes.
Bobby, good time this week. Nice mellow week.
Yeah, it was unpredictable, I'd say.
Yeah. And Charles.
Could have done with it being warmer and lighter.
Yeah. Well, such as this time of year. But this week, we're not talking about last week anymore, we're gazing into our computerized crystal balls to forecast the future of technology. What does the world hold in store for us in 2008? Everything you hear for the next half an hour is wild abandon, a carefully balanced recipe of educated guess and smoke signals. We'll be seeking out the future of green energy, predicting the demise of the latest dot-com bubble, we'll be resizing our technology from large to small, we'll parse the most exciting games releases of 2008, and we'll be hearing from you about what you think the future holds. First up, let's take a dig at the delicate balance between those lovely gadgets and the future of our planet. Charles, what is the future of green energy in the face of our insatiable lust for computer power?
Well, a really interesting study that came out earlier this month by Jonathan Coomey at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory looked at the amount of energy that was used by servers and related cooling gear. It says it doubled over the first 5 years of this decade, reached 123 billion kilowatt hours in 2005. Just to put that in perspective, that's about one third of the amount of energy that the UK national grid can produce. And this is expected to jump by another 76% between 2005-2010. All the servers worldwide, obviously, but it's a huge amount of energy. Now, as oil prices continue to rise, you're going to see the price of electricity go up, which means that all the companies that care about the bottom line are going to be looking for ways to reduce their costs. So they're going to have to look to lower energy use, which means that they're going to look for servers that use far less energy, or they're going to look for renewable sources, green energy sources, which they can tap, which will be cheaper perhaps than oil-based electricity, which they might be able to sell some of the surplus electricity back into the grid.
That's the optimal, of course, but surely some of that might transfer to us, the consumers.
Well, we might get some of the benefit. For example, if you're buying some of this server power, you know, the way that Amazon, for example, is allowing you to buy storage, it's allowing you to buy database, it's allowing you to buy your sort of website capacity. For companies that are doing that sort of thing, it's, you know, any sort of move towards renewable power is going to make the price of renewables drop, which is going to mean that it's going to be more energy efficient.
Bobby, you've got something.
Yeah, I was thinking about this earlier, and I was thinking about Google's plans to make renewable energy cheaper than coal. And I thought, actually, a lot of these projects are really long-term things. You know, you have to work on these technologies for a very, very long time. And Google isn't used to that kind of culture. It's not even that old as a company. And they're used to this idea of you make something in alpha, you stick it out there on the web, it's usually pretty crappy, and then it improves over time. And actually, is that the way that this kind of research works? Because they're not doing this research themselves. It's not kind of Google engineers sitting there coding. But it is them putting their energy and emphasis behind it. So are Larry and Sergey and Eric all going to say, damn, that's taking ages. We're going to take our money and put it somewhere else. You know, we're bored of this. Because I think they suffer from a bit of ADD, really.
The thing we haven't mentioned is the hardware and all the awful toxins and things that go into actually making the physical stuff. Greenpeace, actually, last summer when the iPhone came out, had a very well-orchestrated campaign and a website that was kind of Apple-styled. But there are some really noxious substances that go into them, and that's something that people should be much more aware of.
Yeah. And this is where something like the One Laptop Per Child initiative has really interesting things that it's doing, because it's, you know, they're starting from a clean slate. You know, they're saying, if we could build the best version of this technology, how would we do it? Rather than this incremental improvement that we've seen over time, which does lead to, you know, less eco-friendly, more toxins involved. So, you know, it kind of means you have to rewrite the rule book a lot of the time and say, right, we can't do it that way anymore. We're going to have to work out how to do it a different way.
Charles, what do you see as the outcome of this? Do you see anything actually happening in 2008 with this?
Rather, as in 2007, there were various companies making noises about being more green in terms of the using fewer toxins in their manufacturing process and trying to use metals that could be reused. I think there's going to be a lot of noise about it, but without some sort of political will behind it, these things tend not to happen. When regulations change and force companies to change, then the companies change pretty fast.
Excellent. Thanks very much for that, Charles. Now, over the past year, pundits like us have been describing the rise of social software and the new web applications as the Web 2.0 bubble. The last spike in the late 90s lasted for 3 years, but is this one actually about to burst already? Here's Matt Wells from Media Talk on one of the biggest internet sales of the year.
There have been rumours for months, but this week it was confirmed that the music recommendation site Last.fm is to be sold to CBS for $280 million. Not quite as much as the kind of $500 million that whatever it was that MySpace went for, but, still a
not the $500 million MySpace went for. Come on, Jemima, 280 million clams aren't bad. Does this really portend the end of the bubble?
If you speak to anyone who's actually involved in the industry, none of them think it's going to crash this time. Yes, we've had some crazy valuations. One of the craziest, apart from MySpace, was YouTube last year, $1.65 billion. And Microsoft's 1.6% stake in Facebook valued it at some crazy figure.
$15 billion.
It was $15 billion. Yeah, you're right.
Phenomenal.
Dollars.
Yeah, which is a crazy amount of money. Enormous numbers on businesses where they're not entirely sure how they're going to make money yet. But there's a big but here. You talk to people that are inside the industry, that are in startups, that are in venture companies. They're much more experienced this side around. They have a much more realistic understanding of their industry and the people involved in it and of the business models involved. And there are other factors such as the penetration of broadband in the UK. The internet is a much more staple part of people's lives. The really important part is advertising. The figure for this year was that online advertising was worth $2 billion in the UK, which, if you've got that amount of money underpinning an industry, I don't think there's going to be a crash.
Certainly before it seemed as if it was definitely on a big bubble of air, and I think everybody kind of knew that at the same time.
I think there's plenty of bullshit being talked totally. At the moment.
Yeah.
But the crucial thing that we don't have is investors going really crazy.
Yeah.
The venture capital companies and the investors aren't necessarily putting in vast sums of money into completely non-profit making businesses. And crucially, they're not pushing them to launch on the stock exchange. So, we've seen a couple of IPOs this year. I think we'll see a few next year. But what we've seen are some of the ropier profitability ideas, like, say, Classmates, which recently said it was going to launch on the stock exchange and then has withdrawn that since then. They've kind of realised that, you can't just go public, make loads of money out of it, cash out and go. And that's kind of what really led to the bubble getting so big and so dangerous last time around.
I've got to say, I'm the sceptic here. I mean, I was a sceptic the last time around. There was an analysis done by a PR company in the dot-com bubble the first time around. And I was found to be the journalist on national newspapers who was the least optimistic about the way that these things went. And, I think I was proved right. This time around, I think there's two things. First of all is the credit crunch, which is going to have very far-reaching effects. It still hasn't played out, and that's going to be affecting the way that companies can borrow money from banks for quite a way into the future. I mean, the sort of conversation we were having just now, if we hadn't been talking about Web 2.0 sites, it could have been about houses. People saying, well, the valuations look ridiculous, but hey, people are still paying. I think that house prices are moving down. I think that we're going to see quite a few companies which don't actually have any way of sustaining themselves. They don't have any way to pay the bill because the cash flow isn't there, going out of business. And it's going to be a rough year,
and,
I think.
Yeah, and I think the advertising point that Jemima made is really interesting because because it's all very well to stick advertising in to prop up your business and make money. But actually, the way the web works is somebody else comes along with a version of your site that doesn't have advertising on, and everyone goes, hey, we kind of like that. That's better. That's cooler. I mean, look at YouTube. How long ago did Google buy it? And it still really doesn't have any way of making money. They're starting to look at advertising. They're starting to roll it out. But it's really limited. And I think that's because they're scared that YouTube could easily be replaced by something else.
But the internet is so much a part of our lives day to day. And social networks in particular, as we were saying, I think, on the last podcast, they're trying to work their way into our lives as kind of portals. And if you look at the media industry and the very big struggles that they've got in trying to digitise their content and digitise their business models. Social networks are the sort of R&D for the media industry. And the experiments that they're doing on Facebook, for example, with Beacon, their slightly controversial kind of advertising systems, but incredibly targeted advertising. These are going to set the templates and the business models for the whole of the rest of the internet.
But in 2000, it was a fall in advertising which presaged the whole sort of dot-com bust, really.
Advertising is so much more nuanced, and I think the balance between offline, traditional and online advertising, the value is really there in digital when it's that targeted.
But you can always... You get hit by an unpredictable thing. In 2001, you had September 11th, and that actually just slaughtered everything. There was,
true, but things were bad. Things were bad before.
They were. But something comes along and it kills it, and we can't predict what that might be.
This is clearly something for its own podcast.
Yes.
So while it appears that the web bubble is contracting for some and expanding for others, the number of touch points for technology is increasing. From GPS to data, we now want and expect to carry it with us wherever we go. But what does that actually mean for the nefarious folks who want to infect us with viruses?
Most of the new interesting stuff has been around spyware or spying tools, things that are installed on the phone and will monitor what you're doing. And these are available not just for Symbian Series 60 second edition and Symbian Series 60 third edition phones, which are the most common smartphones, but also for things like BlackBerries or Windows Mobile.
That was Mikko Hipponen, Chief Research Officer at mobile security firm F-Secure, discussing the many potential uses for new bad things to follow us where we go. Charles, what are the dangers of going mobile?
Well, there are more and more smartphones out there which have internet and data capability. The phone networks are falling over themselves now, after many years of not doing it, to let us have flat rate data plans, which means that we can access the internet wherever we are using all sorts of smartphones. And as a consequence, the guys who are writing the viruses are looking at writing these rootkits and things which basically sit on your phone without you knowing, which will follow what you're doing. They'll look at what sort of phone calls you're making, they'll look at what sort of internet sites you're going for, and they'll follow those. The appearance of the iPhone, for example, in June was followed by not just malicious hackers, but also security sites who really focus on it to see if they could find a way to break it. And quite a few did find ways to hack into the Safari web browser on it. I would expect that's going to continue, that you're going to see more people trying to find ways to hack in, especially to high-profile products like the iPhone, which have a lot of data stored on them, which is in a fairly well-known format because it's the same as the one on the computer.
This is actually a nice addendum to what we were talking about last time, which was data security, in that what people were doing on the internet and what they are doing on the internet, they're collecting behavioral data. And this is yet another touch point to follow how people are wandering around, what they're using these data points for.
Just imagine, the evolution of smartphones, the number of people that are carrying them around in their pockets now. If that continues to increase the way we've seen it, we all think, spam is annoying. But what if spam is being sent by the million from every phone, not just a lot of computers, but lots and lots of phones as well? I mean, the potential there is both scary and just ludicrous in scale, really.
And people with Macs can get increasingly less smug as there are more more viruses being made.
But there was an interesting article written in 2007 by Walt Mossberg of the Wall Street Journal, who was saying, would we bear it if our computers were like our phones and were so corralled and you could only do a certain number of things? And I was thinking, well, there's some point of that. But then again, you look at the fact that, there's all the botnets, which are all the compromised PCs, which are spewing out, billions of spams per day. And if you consider that your phone is pretty locked down, and it's pretty difficult to do that for most of the simple phones. Of course, the smartphones that we're seeing out there, the ones with the greater internet capabilities, don't have that sort of protection. I think actually that, the trade-off so far with mobile phones, where they're more locked down, has been to some extent in the consumer's favour.
This is one of the big things. The phone networks are getting increasingly rattled by the likes of Google, bidding for spectrum in the US or coming up with their open mobile platform. And I think the operators are now looking at that and saying, we have to throw our hands up and say, okay, we're going to go along with some of this. On the other hand, it will come down, much as it does with computer platforms. Some people go for different programs and different systems because they feel they're better or they're more secure and all these things. And it suddenly changes the way that the operators look at it. And the operators, I think, have been really destructive to the mobile industry. They try and keep it all very close device and make as much money out of it as they can. And it's a double-edged sword for them.
That certainly has been the way for a lot of the applications that for example, games that have been built on mobile phones and has stood in the way of a lot of the connectivity. But thanks very much for that, Charles. You can check out more about this and also about green power when the technology section returns to the newsstands on the 3rd of January. But as an adjunct to the whole going mobile feature, Bobby, it seems that everywhere we look, gadgets are getting smaller and smaller. And when I was thinking about this feature, I was reminded of the scene in Zoolander in the Ben Stiller movie when he answers a phone and it's really, really small. It's the size of his thumbnail.
Give us a blue steel.
Look at that blue steel.
Oh, awesome.
Whoa. We need a webcam.
It works so well on radio.
Definitely a face for radio.
Is this what's going to happen to our technology in 2008?
There is clearly this trend for smaller and smaller devices and smaller and more powerful. So if you look, obviously the iPhone came along last year, which...
It's not that small.
It's pretty big, well, isn't it? It's a bit of a hefty.
Well, that's, I think personally, is one of the best implemented kind of handheld computers that we've seen so far. But it's only going to increase from there. And not only more powerful phones, but also kind of more powerful, smaller, less expensive laptops. I mean, the notebooks that are coming out now, like the Asus E, the RM notebook, that are really focusing on this kind of ultra-portable side of things. Interestingly, not the ultra-portable PCs that Bill Gates has been so fascinated by, not this kind of tiny touchscreen with these really awkward-to-type-with buttons, but much more like a traditional laptop, less fully featured, but more useful for what you're doing. So we're seeing all of this coming along, and then there's the iPhone software developer kit coming along. That'll make that a more powerful platform. And we're hearing lots of rumours, about Apple launching a tiny notebook at Macworld in San Francisco, and I will be there and reporting back to the podcast. Well, I don't think they'll ever go tablet.
Can they just make one for me?
One of the problems with all these small devices, though, is the user interface. Because if you've got something that's so small, I've got relatively normal sized fingers, but I can't,
They're like bananas, Alex. Come on.
But I can't do certain things on machines because they're just, the keys are simply too small. You need that kind of Minority Report pulling things out of the air, bringing them together in order to actually use some of these devices.
That's why things like touchscreens are now much more important than they have been in the past. Because if you get it right, you can manipulate them a lot better. I mean, I've always had a problem using Windows mobile phones because they just try and squeeze the desktop down onto a tiny, tiny screen. But actually, if you're looking at single implementations, if you're looking at, I'm using the phone or the laptop to do this, and then I'm going to switch to something else, you don't have to give someone the whole experience in one go. I think that's what they're learning. But I just think we're just going to see lots and lots of people walking around in the next year with really small devices that actually are much more affordable. At the moment, if you want to buy a tiny laptop, you pay 10 times the price for it.
Do good things come in small packages in this case?
What about do small things come in converged packages as well? I mean, I'm kind of the argument, yes, I do want my iPod and my diary and my phone all on one computer, all on one sort of device, but lots of other people don't think the same.
It gets sort of impossible to handle them all. I mean, the interface really does become the thing that drives you crazy. And actually, in those cases, it becomes simpler just to have three things, which each have their own sort of manageable interface.
It's something of a normal size so that you can actually interact with them.
Yeah.
So that you don't lose them at the bottom of your purse or pocket. Happens all the time.
I once lost an iPod Nano for about 3 weeks in a book. It just got caught between the pages. It was so annoying.
Well, thank you very much, Bobby, for giving us a lovely overview of the future of teeny, teeny gadgets. Personally, I don't want a mobile phone that's the size of my thumbnail. I don't care how fashionable it is. Enough of our postulating. Before Christmas, we asked readers of the technology blog to send in their predictions for the next year of gadgetry. Jemima, you're first. What are they saying?
Okay, this is from Joe H. I'm going a bit Euro trash, but I am most looking forward to devices, brackets, peripherals, which push the envelope in terms of how we interact with technology. Oh, no, I can't keep up. Of how we interact with technology. Specifically, I'm talking about games like Rock Band. Played it on Saturday night. It's very good. And others currently under development, which will out-Wii the Wii and allow player immersion on an unprecedented level. Also, touchscreens on larger devices, such as laptops and desktops. That sounds horribly like that Microsoft coffee table thing, yeah. Surface, doesn't it?
Wasn't there another? I'm sure, and this going completely off the topic, but wasn't there another tabletop a couple of years ago from LG or Panasonic or something?
Bjork had something like that on her.
There's a guy called Jeff Hann who demonstrated one of the, yes, of the fantastic tools.
That is awesome, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Charles, you've got the next comment.
Okay, Owly Ross, who I think sort of comes across a bit buffed and tuffed in his order. An e-ink e-reader with a touchscreen and no other buttons. It'll still be crippled by DRM, though.
This was one of the big things of 2007, but the launch of the Kindle from Amazon.
And, it's tiny, though. I saw one the other day. It's tiny.
They're very small, but still not getting it right, is it? And I read a report recently that said one of the Philips spin-offs, I think, who make flexible paper, are ready to launch one of their new gadgets. And it's kind of, is this one of the things for 2008 that finally somebody gets this right?
Oh, well, that electric paper is really cool. I saw a prototype of that. And going back to the green thing, it doesn't need any power to display a page. It only needs power to refresh the page. And this was an ugly prototype version. But when they nail that, that's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, but will they? That's the question.
Yes, of course they will, Bobby. Look at all the flying cars everywhere.
Bobby, your turn. On that subject,
Simon 83 says in 2008 he's looking forward to flying cars.
Hey! Give the man a
but
prize.
But not only that, a robot that can eat chips and fire eggs out of its rear end.
I've seen that in Futurama.
A trip to Mars on an open-top bus, fire that turns into mushrooms, and Indiana Jones Lego.
Yes!
And I have to say, I agree with him wholeheartedly on the Indiana Jones Lego bit. It's a game I'm looking forward to. Incredibly.
It will be very, very good. Yeah. Thanks very much, Bobby, for that, and also to everybody else. And also thank you very much to the readers for your far-fetched and fantastic predictions. If you'd like to comment, make your own predictions, or just say hello, please head to the website at guardian.co.uk/technology or come on over to the blogs at blogs.guardian.co.uk. Now, late this year, the BBC launched the first free-to-air HD channel.
Family, food and heavily applied foundation now on BBC HD. And there's some strong language too as we get under the skin of TV's first celebrity chef. This is Fear of Fanny.
Indeed. Getting Under the Skin, one of the channel's top new programmes. Listen to everybody, Fanar Fanar. After a year of HD sales, it's difficult to see who the front runners are in the race. It is nice, however, to see that players and HD TVs are plunging in price, making the technology affordable to the common man. But Bobby, what does this foretell for 2008?
I'm still slightly dumbfounded by the idea of Fear of Fanny, but anyway, 2007 was a year when we saw Blu-ray and HD DVD kind of start going head-to-head. We'd all been waiting for it for a long time. They started clashing horns. 2008, I think, is the year when we'll really see something resolve here. We'll see them butt heads until something breaks. I think that's for a number of reasons. Firstly, it's because the BBC in the UK is going to start broadcasting lots of HD. They've got permission to now. They've started doing it. Up until now, we've only seen it on Sky and Virgin in relatively small numbers. But this takes it to the masses, as does the Olympics later in the year. You know, all of these things often hinge on big sporting events. Now, the Olympics, I don't think, is quite the same as a big football tournament, but there's already lots of advertising going around saying, you know, this is the HD Olympics, it's going to be a good one. And I think people going out there now are generally looking at the prices and saying, I can afford to buy one of these. The really interesting thing is that if Blu-ray doesn't win, Sony has just bet the farm, really, on victory. The PlayStation 3 relies on Blu-ray and they want it to be the Trojan to bring it into people's houses. But HD, you know, it's putting up more of a fight than we thought it might. And we could see by the end of the year, you know, one of these companies, Sony or Toshiba, could really take a serious blow if they don't win out.
It is quite dangerous that Sony have put so much of an emphasis on the Blu-ray disc. But I'm also thinking, how much is it going to cost people to swap over? And also, how much is it going to cost those parts and the development of those technologies, those televisions that are coming into people's homes?
Oh, people don't care about that. Come on.
But I'm bringing it to the people.
I know. But there was a good graphic in Good Magazine. We'll make sure the link's on the blog somewhere so that you can go and have a look at it. But it compared the consumption of different devices in your household. And actually, an HD plasma takes up loads, LCD not so much. But actually your computer is probably one of the most power hungry things in the household, and I don't think people really go out there and buy because of the green credentials, and certainly not yet. It's a small segment of the market, and I'm not sure what the details are on the difference between Blu-ray and HD DVD in green terms, but certainly I think that's just about a wholesale jump from standard definition to high definition, and actually you're more interested in the picture than the cost.
I mean, the big problem for HD DVD versus Blu-ray, what they're really waiting for is for Warner's to come down on one side or the other of the fence, because that's the film studio which is really going to decide it. And there are talks that Sony is, plighting its troth to Warner's, and obviously the HD DVD group are as well. And they're waiting for them to come through and decide which one it is. And that could actually be decisive one way or another. Though the question still becomes one of, well, yeah, are people really going to go through this again? Will they replace their DVDs that they bought at whatever expense with high definition ones? Or will they instead just perhaps hire the higher definition DVDs and just watch those, in which case it's going to be the blockbusters of this world who are going to be bearing the cost.
I'm of the one screen school. At the moment, my telly is sort of a pathetic kind of maybe 12-inch wide tiny thing that I don't really watch that much. And I've got a lovely big computer screen that I absolutely adore. I just want to be able to go and download an HD film when I want it. Watch it on my computer.
I think you can, though it's not legal.
Well, yes. Obviously, we're all strictly legit.
Yeah, I don't think iPlayer's in HD yet, but you never know. It might somewhere down the line.
Yeah, but it's full screen.
Give them a chance. They're only just doing streaming.
Yeah. Well, you know, they work fast, these BBC guys. I kind of agree with Charles in as much as if you hold off jumping into this battle because you're not sure which way it's going to go. Nobody wants to buy the next Betamax player. The longer people hold off, and the sales aren't massive for any of these things, the more crippling the damage becomes to both sides. So what happens, you know, if by the end of 2008 nobody is the winner, then what happens then? Do they both go through another 10 rounds of, you know, smacking each other around the chops?
But will it be decided like VHS and Betamax, which was basically determined by the porn industry, wasn't it?
Well,
it's not quite clear who. I've heard so many versions.
Oh, my God, HD porn.
Clive James said that it was more to do with whether you could fix the VHS ones. It was easier to fix the VHS than the BBC. Yeah, I've heard loads of different versions of which ones it was. So.
Finally, the last bit in this programme, in a whole different kind of race, 2008 is the year the games of the future will finally launch. Or at least that's what they tell us.
Nico! My cousin! Hey! I can't believe it, you're here! Welcome to America!
Bravo, Barazzaru!
Come in, come in!
This is the mansion?
The mansion is coming, cousin. That's the dream.
What do you mean?
We're going to the top, Nico. Soon, even you will forget about the old country.
Now, we must fight these people. It's them or us, cousin.
So you in, big guy? We're going to have to kill you.
If anybody can identify what that accent
is...
Yeah,
I think it was fictionalovia.
Please do send comments into the blog, because that's preposterous. But clearly that was the GTA 4 trailer, replete with terrible acting. That was really awful acting. To say that the game is eagerly anticipated is to laugh at the whole phenomenon while it carjacks you and shoots you in the head. Creators Rockstar have been dribbling as little as they possibly can to the public, so now, of course, the public is ravenous with excitement. The games bloggers asked the people on the games blog which games people are most looking forward to. And out of the humongous group of games that were submitted, the leader was without a doubt Little Big Planet, which is coming out for the Sony PlayStation 3, which is good news for Sony in that it brings that whole social networking concept into the game sphere. What it is effectively is it's a platform for people to create their own games. So in a way, it's like MySpace for the gaming generation. People can create stuff and then they can develop reputations and have friends and this and that and the other. So it should be quite an interesting product that does come out, and hopefully it's created in such a way that will be accessible to not only gamers but also to everybody else. Because ultimately, as we've seen with the Wii, that is the thing that's pushing things forward.
The very clever kind of online social network that they've put with the Sing Store on SingStar, so you can kind of upload your video, God knows where you want to, but you can upload your video to this network and also watch everybody else's very very entertaining kind of You've Been Framed style videos.
Utterly humiliating.
That's painful,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is. That is a really important part of 2008 gaming. The whole social network integration, because we've also got Xbox Live has recently brought its own social networking platform into this. And it's part of the move of the games industry to really ensure that people stick on their platform, that they hold on to them because all of their friends are hanging out on this one platform. Some of the other things that people are looking forward to, Greg Howson is looking forward to Alan Wake, which is a Twin Peaks sort of Silent Hill style adventure, which he says should break some of the monotony of sequels driving games and face the shooters that are coming out next year.
Come on. You can't get rid of the sequels.
Please. I wish for the end of sequels. But of course, next year sees another sequel, which is Gran Turismo 5. So another whole bunch of strapping a rubber band around your controller so that the car just goes around in circles. And
I'm not a fan of driving games, but I think they're the ones that really have to work out how to harness the social aspect a lot better. I've not, there are titles out there that are okay at it, but I haven't really played one that's made me think, wow, I can race somebody, in the far-flung corner of the universe and call them a lamer.
And that's supposed to be
the
point.
Thing here.
Yeah.
But that is ultimately supposed to be the whole point of multiplayer. And it in fact, on any of the platforms, the multiplayer racing games are those that become the most successful instantly, but primarily because you get a whole bunch of kids shouting at you across the Atlantic, calling you all kinds of
I'll tell you a game I'm hoping will come out in 2008. Nobody's entirely sure, but we might finally see Spore from Will Wright. I spoke to him a few months ago, and I don't really still know what the game's going to play like, but I just love the fact that someone's got this massive vision that you take bacterium and you evolve it into a life form, and you go through all the different stages. And I think, it probably won't be as big as everyone's predicted, because it's the energy's kind of gone for it a little bit. But I'm still looking forward to playing it and having a go.
It should be an interesting product.
Yeah, I think Star Wars for the Wii, that's the one for me.
Oh, lightsaber
action. The lightsaber.
Absolutely, got to get your lightsaber. I mean, it was so obvious. The first time I saw the Wii, I thought, someone's got to be in there riding a game where you got the lightsaber. It's obvious.
I'm amazed they didn't have a launch title that used that, the lightsaber action.
Maybe probably they couldn't get the Nintendo Wii to George Lucas in time, George, try this. I'm doing another film.
I want them to combine a dancing and a singing game. So you have to do the steppy on the paddy thing and do the singing at the same time.
Combine that with Rock Band, which is coming out in the UK in January.
Isn't it called X Factor? Pop Band or something.
Exactly. Yeah. Those are our predictions for 2008. We'll let you know how we do when 2009 rolls around. But until then, we have at least 52 episodes to record. I'm Alex Krotowski, and as always, thanks very much to Jemima, to Bobby, and to Charles, and of course, the man behind the curtain, our producer, Scott. Thanks very much for listening to Tech Weekly, and have a great new year.
Guardian Unlimited.